Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Wednesday, June 28th. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, Pfluger details importance of Permian energy. Nation's energy resources will help address global security challenges, he said. By Mella McEwen, staff writer. This industry is the most important tool we have in our national security arsenal, said Representative August Pfluger. The San Angelo Republican, who represents District 11, which includes Midland and Odessa, addressed energy issues Tuesday with the Permian Basin Petroleum Association at the Petroleum Club. He told the gathering he was elected to the House of Representatives to highlight the national security implications of the oil and natural gas industry. The Permian Basin, he said, is the epicenter of a shale revolution that has lifted a billion people out of poverty and changed the geopolitical equation, giving the U.S. economic strength and the ability to be a global energy provider to allies. His colleagues in the House are aware of its importance, he said, though half may disagree. I'm working on convincing that half, he said. I'm trying to convince them to look at the next 50 years and see oil demand will continue to grow, that hydrocarbons will expand. Let's not have a president that goes to Saudi Arabia, to Iran, to ask for more oil. He should talk to Mayor Lori Blong, not Saudi Arabia. The industry is at the heart and soul of national security, he reiterated. And the nation is in a period of national security challenges that are more serious than at any time in recent memory. Not only are those challenges coming by land, air, and sea, but through different domains like cyberspace, state-sponsored threats, non-traditional threats, and non-state actors. As the nation looks at challenges across the world, from Ukraine-Russia conflict to the threat of China invading Taiwan, the only answer from the U.S. has to be extreme strength, economic strength, a prepared military, and alliances and partnerships with allies across the world who trust us to do what we say we'll do. All of that will be the result of having energy. None of that will happen without energy. Affordable, reliable energy. Pfluger said he rejects the term all of the above, preferring best of the above. He said he wants energy that will work, that is reliable, that can be used daily by households and businesses to lower energy costs, that can be used by the military and allies around the globe. He was critical of what he called the Biden administration's war on fossil fuels, saying the administration is attempting to curb U.S. oil and natural gas production. That sends power to China, he said, where the rare earths needed for batteries are mined, and where Chinese companies operate similar mines in Africa. They don't care about the climate, they care about energy, he said, noting they open multiple coal-fired power plants weekly. We have the resources, and we need to use them appropriately. Pfluger is declaring war on entities like the Environmental Protection Agency that he said don't have the public's best interest at heart. He criticized policies like the Endangered Species Act, Waters of the United States, and potential redesignation of the Permian Basin, as in non-attainment under ambient ozone standards, as weapons against the industry. There is hope, he said, with the reform of the National Environmental Policy Act, as well as the Republicans' energy policy, H.R. 1, included in the recent Debt Ceiling Act. Reform of NEPA to require environmental impact studies be done within 2 years and environmental reviews in 1 year is a solid first step that could free up 229 hydrocarbon-related projects, he said. He credited the PBPA with helping craft the narrative used to get the reform across the finish line. He is also among those working hard to take out the methane fee, which he called a natural gas tax, that was part of last year's Inflation Reduction Act. He and his fellow Republicans are also conducting what he called necessary oversight of regulatory agencies, including the EPA and Department of Energy. We're punching holes in their math, pushing back on regulations like tailpipe emissions, he said. This article is called Beat the Heat, 10 Local Spots Keeping You Cool, by Morgan Taylor Thomas, staff writer. Snow Cones, AA Shave Paradise. With not even 2 weeks of business to claim, one might be skeptical to try this brand new shop. Yet a handful of recommendations via fellow Midlanders puts AA Shave Paradise on the list. 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. Tuesday through Friday. 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Saturday and Sunday. 304 East Florida Avenue. Keats Sweets. What started as a food truck now claims a spot in the micro-market district of downtown. 100 flavors, 10 toppings, and 2 sizes make Keats Sweets one of the most diverse snow cone shops in town. Guests can also enjoy rolled ice cream available in 8 flavors. 1 to 8 p.m. Wednesday through Sunday, 201 West Wall Street, Suite 107A. Melted Snow Company. Weekly specials ranging from flavors such as sour strawberry to horchata make this downtown hotspot a must-try. Melted Snow Company also carries float-style sips and freeze-dried candy. Noon to 9 p.m. Monday through Saturday. 1 to 8 p.m. Sunday. 214 West Texas Avenue. Rock and Roll Snow. More than 75 snow cone options, sweet drinks, and more can be found at this beloved Midland classic. Rock and Roll Snow also offers 6 sugar-free options, a dye-free cherry, and ever-changing additions depending on the season. Currently, extra flavors include chocolate fudge, butterscotch, and French vanilla. 3 to 9 p.m. Monday through Saturday, 2 to 8 p.m. Sunday. 218 North Midkiff Road. Southern Snow. Self-proclaimed as Midland's original shaved ice trailer, customers can usually find a group of local teens running the truck. The stand also carries an array of merch. Coasters, hats, t-shirts, and more. 2 to 9 p.m. Monday through Saturday, 925 West Wadley Avenue. Ice Cream. Fountainville Creamery and Soda Fountain. Made from scratch artisan ice cream, flavored with fellow Permian Basin business products such as Pecos Cantaloupe, makes Fountainville a bucket list item for Texans all over. We're so lucky. Noon to 9 p.m. Tuesday through Thursday and Sunday. Noon to 10 p.m. Friday and Saturday. Pop Bar. Technically, Pop Bar is not a local establishment. However, only 2 Texas locations for the chain reside in Midland and Odessa. Decadent sorbet and gelato popsicles covered in frozen sauces, drizzles, and more can't be beat on a hot West Texas summer day. 11:30 a.m. to 7 p.m. Monday through Thursday. 11:30 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. Friday and Saturday. 200 Spring Park Drive, Suite 300. Queen Bee Palateria. Simplicity doesn't exist here. extravagant arrangements made from fresh toppings and aesthetically pleasing containers make Queen Bee one of a kind. Enjoy shakes, cones, smoothies, and more. 1:30 to 8:30 p.m. Wednesday through Sunday. 1313 North La Mesa Road. Refreshers. Jimmy T's Drive-Thru. Beyond a stacked menu of munchies, Jimmy T's Agua Frescas go above and beyond. Made daily with fresh fruit and other ingredients, all 12 drinks quench a thirst and leave you wanting more. Buy one, get one free runs 2 to 5 p.m. during the week. 11 a.m. to 11 p.m. Monday through Sunday. 4321 West Illinois Avenue. Other. Tea to go, HTO, Preso Tea, T180, Kung Fu Tea. Just a few of the tea and energy drink restaurants around town. Although they are chain businesses, they're owned and operated by franchising Midlanders. And with temperatures continuing to soar above 100 degrees, sometimes you just want an ice-cold sweet tea. Varying locations and hours. This article is entitled, Council Firefighters Come Together to Fix Pension. Leaders, the Midland Firemen's Relief and Retirement Fund is underfunded by $109 million. By Stuart Doreen, staff writer. Midland City Council and members of the Midland firefighting community vowed to work together to solve a common problem. The Midland Firemen's Relief and Retirement Fund is underfunded by $109 million. The current pension benefits are just not sustainable for future retirees, said Chad Clark, a former firefighter, a current financial advisor, and member of the fund's board. The fund can no longer sustain that. City leaders, members of the Relief and Retirement Fund board, and Midland Fire Department leadership were consistent with their comments that the problem didn't happen for any one reason and didn't happen overnight. The estimates were this was a problem at least 10 to 15 years in the making. They also explained a nine-figure underfunded amount happening because of multiple governance, investment, and funding problems. Those included benefit design deficiencies, high amounts of overtime due to understaffing, lower investment returns than assumed, changes in actuarial assumptions, and lack of timely action by the Relief and Retirement Fund's previous Board of Trustees. In Tuesday's reporter telegram, Midland Mayor Lori Blong laid the foundation for the fund's past and present. On Tuesday, at the Bush Convention Center, officials talked more about the future. They stated that the department and fund will benefit from increased staffing levels. They added, new investment and policy committees have been developed, and a new investment advisor could start as early as July. Other measures include, the first two items of significant change to the actual funding are set to be voted on by the Midland Fire Department in July 2023. These would remove unscheduled overtime and instead calculate benefits based on consecutive pay periods rather than non-consecutive ones, which is typically the standard for retirement benefits. These two items must be voted on by the Midland Fire Department per state statute and cannot be made by City Council decision. But they are critical to begin reducing the unfunded liability of the fund, according to the city. I think we're going to take this in steps with the consultants that we've already got on board, Blong said after the press conference, and we're going to take some of their suggestions to tackle the low-hanging fruit, the things that we can move the needle. Just with city contributions and with fire department contributions towards their own benefit, restructure the benefit plan, and then do another actuarial evaluation to see where those measures have gotten us with the amount of underfunding. Once we have that new number from the new actuarial evaluation, we're going to be faced with how to make up that deficit. And there will still be a deficit. And so, at that point, the city council and the board will have to make a decision if we want to take that to the voters or if we want to pursue some other avenue. Right now, I feel like the most appropriate thing is going to be to take it to the voters. Clark said the reason he can be encouraged, even with the bad news, is the unity between the city and the fire department. The Midland Firemen's Relief and Retirement Fund, according to the city, was historically very healthy and well-funded, with some of the richest benefits in Texas. Following a decline in the funding structure and with investments in November of 2021, the Texas Pension Review Board in Austin requested a meeting with the fund's board leadership and discussed the need for an intensive actuarial review and forensic audit, as well as the need to employ an investment consultant. An intensive actuarial review found that the Midland Firefighters Relief and Retirement Fund is currently projected to run out of assets in 22 years. The previous mayor and council strongly pushed for quick response and cooperation at the time the Pension Review Board identified the need, according to the city. Also, since a November 2022 meeting with the Texas Pension Review Board, Midland Firefighters Relief and Retirement Fund elections have taken place. By the end of February 2023, the MFRRF received a full forensic audit, a full governance audit, and an updated actuarial evaluation, the city reported. These documents, along with input from the Texas Pension Review Board and consultants, have provided a framework for the MFRRF to make corrections to the fund. In the Forest Service, one of the things that we always did after a critical incident was to do an after-action review, Clark said. If you're in the corporate world, that may be a post-mortem. And the idea behind that is we want to evaluate what happened, learn from that to correct any deficiencies, and then moving forward, prevent that from happening in the future. Former Mayor Bobby Burns told those in attendance that the city has a great history of doing the right thing, paying its bills, honoring its obligations. On Tuesday, leaders stated that the ongoing conversation is between not only the council, the fund board members, and the fire department, but also the Midland community. This is something that our entire community cares about, Long said. We're asking for a partnership in this decision so that we can say that they're doing this together. The city is going to be partnering with you and moving forward in making up this difference of $109 million. Findings of audits and reviews. The two audits and the actuarial review were extensive, and their reports are available to the public at midlandtexas.gov/firemanpension. This article is entitled Howard County. DPS, Big Spring Man Dies in Crash, by Mercedes Cordero, staff writer. A 69-year-old Big Spring man died Monday after his disabled vehicle was struck on Interstate 20 in Howard County, according to the Department of Public Safety. DPS reported that Carlos Rodriguez's 2012 Buick Enclave was disabled in the eastbound outside lane of I-20 near mile marker 188, quote, due to striking the center median cable in a prior crash, unquote. A 2017 Dodge Ram traveling eastbound on I-20 in the outside lane of travel struck Rodriguez's disabled vehicle from the rear. Rodriguez was pronounced deceased at Scenic Mountain Medical Center in Big Spring. The accident happened at 5:47 p.m. Monday, 1 mile west of Cahoma. Rodriguez was wearing a seatbelt, according to DPS. This article is entitled, "Ex-Director Joins Discussion on Animal Services." City decides to use advisory committee to firm up division policies. By Stuart Doreen, staff writer. The turnout for the animal services discussion item at Tuesday's Midland City Council meeting didn't bring the number of community members some might have thought was possible based on previous public comment periods. The agenda item was to, quote, discuss policy matters related to the City of Midland Animal Service Division's operation of the Midland Animal Shelter. The City Council may consider and take action upon a motion regarding said matters, unquote. Four people brought concerns to city leaders. One was former Animal Services Director Ty Coleman. The City of Midland released Coleman in April after, quote, he did not meet probation, unquote. Coleman used the agenda opportunity to make suggestions and ask questions of Interim City Manager Morris Williamson about shelter operations and procedures. Coleman also came back during the public comment period on the council agenda to express his concerns about city leaders and the operations of the animal shelter. After comments from Coleman and others, Midland City Councilman Dan Corrales attempted to make a motion to have the city manager, or a designee, look at other cities and practices and procedures they have been using with their respective animal services divisions. However, other council members, including Robin Poole, said the processes and procedures have been ongoing with the City of Midland and asked to have the discussion of best practices go through the city's Animal Services Advisory Committee. When it was decided that the committee was a more appropriate place for that discussion, including the firming up of a comprehensive policy, Corrales withdrew his motion. City leaders have previously stated that the City of Midland is responsible for an Animal Services Division that safeguards public health, protects animal welfare, and provides community care and services for animals that have come into the shelter. Currently, the City of Midland is searching for a new Animal Services Director and attempting to partner with the City of Odessa to hire a veterinarian. The City of Midland will provide the next Animal Services Manager with a relatively new 18,400-square-foot facility. It opened in October 2021, and a $2.323 million Animal Services Division budget, which is not only an increase of 31% compared to the previous fiscal year, but a jump of $1 million, or 75%, compared to fiscal year 2019, according to animal services budgets provided by the city. That includes an increase in base salaries for animal services employees from $523,100 in fiscal year 2019 to $991,402 this year, an increase of 89%. Coleman's departure has been a reason those with animal rescues and others have used previous public comment periods to express frustrations to city leaders. On Tuesday, Coleman asked about policies since the death of an animal in the back of an animal services vehicle. City management stated that the city has adjusted transport policies, including taking animals directly to the shelter. During the public comment period, Coleman talked about disagreements he had with city management regarding policies and the spending of money inside the Animal Services Division. During the public comment period, the council, by state statute, does not reply to speakers, but can put an item on a future agenda. It was this statute that Corrales followed to put the discussion item on Tuesday's agenda. This article is entitled, MISD Picks Tommy Bishop as President, by Stuart Doreen, staff writer. After close to a three-hour executive session, the Midland ISD board unanimously voted to make Tommy Bishop the next board president on Monday night. Joining Bishop as officers are Katie Joyner as vice president and Robert Marquez as secretary. The selection of new officers was required as Brian Murray, the former president, resigned from the board. After the board appointed Stephanie Mead to represent District 7, it set the stage for the next selection of officers. The ultimate outcomes saw Bishop and Joyner move up a seat each, as Bishop went from vice president to president and Joyner from secretary to vice president. Robert Marquez picked up the last officer's spot as the new secretary. Bishop is the longest-serving member of the district, having represented District 3 since 2006. This article is entitled, National Weather Service. Midland ties record for consecutive 105-degree days, by Stuart Doreen, staff writer. The record for consecutive days at 105 degrees in Midland was tied Tuesday, according to the National Weather Service. The National Weather Service reported a high temperature of 108 degrees. That means that Tuesday was the ninth straight day that the high temperature reached or topped 105 degrees. The streak tied the high mark set from June 25th to July 3rd in 1994. The streak of 100-degree days reached 13 straight. The NWS is calling for at least three more 100-degree days through Friday. That means the record for consecutive 100-degree days in Midland, 14, also is likely to be tied and broken. The NWS also expects a high temperature of 104 degrees on Wednesday. The NWS also shows high temperatures in the mid-90s this weekend. Tuesday also was the anniversary of the hottest day in Midland's history, 116 degrees, set on June 27, 1994. This article is entitled, Stephanie Mead to Replace Murray on School Board, by Stuart Doreen, staff writer. Stephanie Mead has been appointed to represent Midland ISD District 7. The Midland ISD Board approved Mead's appointment by a 4-2 vote Monday during its board meeting. Votes for Mead to replace Brian Murray were made by Tommy Bishop, Robert Marquez, Sarah Burleson, and Brandon Hodges. Michael Booker and Katie Joyner voted against the appointment. Mead will represent District 7, generally Northwest Midland. District 7 includes the following areas: Greentree, Saddle Club Ranch Estates, Briarwood, Great House, a section bordered by Garfield Street on the east, Midland Drive on the west, Bluebird Avenue on the north, and Loop 250 on the south, and another section bordered by Loop 250 and Briarwood to the north, Wadley Avenue to the south, Holiday Hill and Loop 250 to the west, and Midkiff Road to the east. This article is entitled, Big Bend National Park. Visitors encouraged to take precautions in record heat. By Mercedes Cordero, staff writer. With record-breaking temperatures expected to last well into the month of July, Big Bend National Park officials are encouraging park visitors to take precautions. "We aren't exaggerating when we say it's hot," park officials shared Sunday on the Big Bend National Park Facebook. Park officials stated that temperatures are, quote, predicted to reach temperatures of 120 degrees at Rio Grande Village, 110 degrees at Panther Junction, and 100 degrees up in the Chisos Basin. The National Weather Service issued an excessive heat warning in effect through Tuesday evening. While Big Bend is a popular summer destination, park officials stated that, quote, hiking in the park in these temperatures can be lethal, and we don't recommend it, unquote. Over the weekend, park officials reported that a Florida man and his stepson died Friday while visiting Big Bend. Temperatures at the time were 119 degrees, according to park officials. While visiting the park, follow these tips. 1. Speak to park rangers at the visitor center about your plans before heading out into the park. 2. Drink plenty of water. At least 1 gallon of water per person per day. 3. Have electrolytes or salty snacks with your water. 4. Wear a full brim hat. 5. Wear light fabric, light-colored long-sleeve clothing. 6. Apply sunscreen. 7. Wrap a wet cloth around your neck. 8. Stay in the shade and avoid exposed trails. If a person is planning on hiking, here's how to identify the differences between heat exhaustion and heat stroke. Heat exhaustion symptoms include dizziness, thirst, heavy sweating, nausea, and weakness. A person experiencing heat exhaustion should be moved to a cooler area, clothing should be loosened, and they should sip on cool water. Seek medical help if symptoms don't improve, as they could lead to heat stroke. For heat stroke, symptoms include dizziness, confusion, and possible loss of consciousness. Call 911 immediately and move the person to a cooler area and cool them with water and ice. This is the obituary column, Wednesday, June 28th. David Earl Boone. David Earl Boone was born in Hollywood, California, on September 25, 1968, and died in Midland, Texas, on June 19, 2023. A funeral service to celebrate David's life will be held at the Salvation Army Corps Church, located at 3500 Park Lane, Midland, at 11 a.m. on Thursday, June 29th. Family, friends, and members of the community are invited to attend and pay their respects to a remarkable individual who touched the lives of many. David Boone is survived by his daughter Jessica, his family, and the many friends who shared in his journey. Rest in peace, David Boone, in the loving arms of Jesus Christ. James David Webb, Sr., April 27, 1931 to June 23, 2023. James David Webb, Sr. passed away on Friday, the 23rd of June, in Houston. He was 92 years of age. He was born to Edith Lorena Miller Webb and Arthur Darrell Webb on the 27th of April, 1931, in Big Spring. Jim met Irene Patricia Hogan from Breckenridge, Texas, on a blind date in 1951, and they fell into a true and beautiful love with one another that would last until her sudden and terribly early death in 1975. Pat's death left Jim a 43-year-old widower with 5 children, ages 23 to 7. In the next chapters in his life, he started his own exploration company, moved to Denver, Houston, Arkansas, and back to Midland again. He remarried. He loved his wives. He considered himself a lucky man. He is preceded in death by his wives, Irene Patricia Hogan Webb and Norma Jean Helm Webb, and by his son, James David Webb, Jr. He is survived by his children, Janet Webb, John Webb, Sharon Webb, Jeff Webb, Shirley Webb, and Jill Webb, Susan Webb, as well as 14 grandchildren and 27 great-grandchildren. He will be dearly missed. The family will have gathered for a private interment at Rest Haven Memorial Gardens in Midland. A memorial service will be conducted at 11 o'clock in the morning on Friday, the 30th of June, at First Presbyterian Church. Immediately following, all are invited to greet the family during a reception at the church. Please visit Jim's online memorial tribute at gohlewis.com, where fond memories and words of comfort and condolence may be shared electronically with his family. Joyce Murphy, September 25, 1932 to June 25, 2023. On June 25, 2023, Joyce Linnell Nell Murphy passed away peacefully in her sleep. Nell was born on September 25, 1932 in Ballinger to Edna Margaret Keaton and James Albert Witt. On June 2, 1950, Nell married the love of her life, Jack Meredith Murphy, and shared over 57 years of marriage together before his passing in 2007. Nell is preceded in death by her parents, James and Edna Witt, her brother Bert Witt, her sister Jean McClelland and Catherine Bailey, and her husband Jack Murphy. Nell is survived by her children, Jack M. Murphy Jr., Lynn, of Midland, James Randy Murphy of Garland, and John Larry Murphy, Roxanne of Midland, and by four grandchildren and four great-grandchildren. Her funeral service will be Thursday at 10 a.m. at the Ellis Funeral Home on North Big Spring Street in Midland, with Michael Hawley officiating. Interment will follow at Rest Haven North. Please visit ellisfunerals.com. In lieu of flowers, donations may be made to First Baptist Church of Midland, Interim Hospice, or a charity of your choice. Lola Haler, November 20, 1929 to June 25, 2023. Lola May Haler, Turnbow, age 93, of Andrews, went to be with her Lord and Savior on Sunday, June 25th. The funeral service will be held at 10 a.m. Friday, June 30th at McNett Funeral Home in Andrews. Pastor Darrell G. Trout will be officiating. Burial to follow at Andrews County West Cemetery immediately after. Visitation will be held Wednesday, June 28th from 1 to 8 p.m. and Thursday, June 29th from 1 to 8 p.m. at McNett Funeral Home. Lola was born to Herman Porter Turnbow and Bessie Lang Turnbow in Andrews on November 20, 1929. Lola married Jack H. Fulwider in 1948, and they were married for 36 years until his death in 1984. Lola married Felix Haler in 1995, and they were married for 19 years until his death in 2014. Lola was a full-time wife and mom for 37 years before working as a teacher's aide for special needs children at Clear Fork Elementary in Andrews. Lola is survived by her daughter-in-law, Sharon Fulwider of Andrews, son Gary and Lori Fulwider of Andrews, son Randy and April Fulwider of Gardendale, nine grandchildren and 23 great-grandchildren. Lola is preceded in death by her parents and all her siblings, Jack H. Fulwider, husband, Larry C. Fulwider, son, and Felix Haler, husband. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be given to Meals on Wheels at the Andrews Senior Citizen Center. Death Notices. Debbie Barnes. Debbie Barnes, 47, of Midland, passed away June 22nd. The family will receive guests from 6 to 8 p.m. Thursday, June 29th at the branch at NPW. Funeral service will be held at 11 a.m. Friday, June 30th at Stonegate Fellowship. Interment will follow at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Wells Funeral Home, and online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Glenn Ledford. Glenn Ledford, 62, of Stanton, passed away June 26th. Graveside service will be held at 10 a.m. Thursday, June 29th at Evergreen Cemetery Chapel in Stanton. Arrangements are under the direction of Gilbreth Funeral Home of Stanton, and online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Scott Allen. Scott Michael Allen, 43, of Midland, passed away on Saturday, May 20th, in Midland. A celebration of Scott's life will be held at 2 p.m. on Sunday, July 2nd, at Willowbrook Funeral Home Chapel. Services are entrusted to Willowbrook Funeral Home, and to place online condolences, please visit www.willowbrk.com.
Fire restrictions in place for Lincoln National Forest. The Lincoln National Forest has implemented Stage 1 fire restrictions effective June the 28th as dry weather and heightened fire danger risk continues. These restrictions will help reduce the risk of human-caused wildfires as we enter a time of high fire danger and elevated fire weather conditions, said Dave Bales, Lincoln National Forest Fire Staff Officer, in a press release. Criteria such as current and extended weather reports, fuel moistures, fire activity, and available firefighting resources are all a part of the decision-making process. The following are prohibited under Stage 1 fire restrictions: igniting, building, maintaining, attending, or using a campfire or stove fire, including charcoal grills and briquettes, with the exception of Forest Service provided fire structures, examples of a metal ring or permanent on-site grill within developed campgrounds and day use areas. Propane grills, stoves, and lanterns with an on-off switch are still permitted. Smoking, with the exception of within a closed vehicle or building, a developed recreation site, or while stopped in an area at least 3 feet in diameter that is barren or cleared of any flammable material. Fireworks and other pyrotechnic devices are always prohibited on national forests. Violators of these restrictions are subject to fines and/or imprisonment. We appreciate the public's help in working with us to make sure that our forest, firefighters, and neighboring communities stay safe, Bales said. A blistering heat wave is turning up the pressure on Texas's power grid. On another 100-degree day in Texas, Sam Whitaker lingered outside a Dallas cafe after polishing off an iced coffee, having switched off the power to everything back home except his refrigerator. "That's the reason I'm out," said Whitaker, 52, finding shade at a patio table. As an unrelenting heat wave grips Texas for a second week, public appeals to stay hydrated and limit outdoor activities have come with another ask of the state's nearly 30 million residents: conserve electricity if possible, as demand on the power grid is stretched to projected record peaks. An early summer arrival of blistering temperatures, which has been blamed for at least 2 deaths, is taxing Texas's power grid that many residents still view nervously 2 years after a deadly winter blackout. Regulators warn that Texas may offer a preview of what could be tight demand on grids across the U.S. this summer because of extreme temperatures worsened by climate change. On Tuesday, the Texas grid was operating under an elevated weather watch that does not ask residents to curtail power, but raises the possibility. Even some energy experts who have been critical of Texas's grid management consider outages this summer unlikely, saying winter carries bigger risks. But as scorching temperatures in some parts of Texas climb above 110 degrees, flirting with records or breaking them outright, air conditioners are cranked and officials are nudging homeowners to be mindful of their electricity usage. Please, please do what you can to conserve energy, said Stuart Riley, interim general manager of Austin Energy, which serves more than 500,000 customers in Texas's capital. Forecasters say relief in Texas may not arrive before the 4th of July holiday. The culprit is a stalled heat dome forged by an unpleasant mix of stationary high pressure, warmer than usual air in the Gulf of Mexico, and the sun beating overhead, according to John Nielsen Gammon, the state's climatologist. For some, the conditions have been deadly. Last week, a Florida man and his 14-year-old stepson died after hiking in extreme heat at Big Bend National Park in far west Texas, where temperatures soared to 119 degrees. In Austin, paramedics have responded to more than 100 heat-related incidents the past 2 weeks alone, which city officials say accounts for more than half of all their heat-related emergency calls since April. Hot weather has not caused rolling outages in Texas since 2006, but operators of the state's grid, the Electric Reliability Council of Texas, have entered recent summers not ruling out the possibility as a crush of new residents strains an independent system. Texas mostly relies on natural gas for power, which made up more than 40% of generation last year, according to ERCOT. Wind accounted for about 25%, with solar and nuclear energy also in the mix. Texas's grid is not connected to the rest of the country, unlike others in the U.S., meaning there are few options to pull power from elsewhere if there are shortages or failures. In May, regulators warned the public that demand may outpass supply on the hottest days. We have the equivalent of the entire city of Oakland, California, moving to Texas every year, said Peter Lake, who at the time was chairman of the state's Public Utility Commission, but resigned earlier this month. California has come close to running out of power in recent years, especially in the early evenings when electricity from solar is not as abundant. In Texas, Republicans' attitudes towards renewables have soured since the 2021 winter blackout, when conservative commentators falsely blamed wind turbines and solar energy as the prime driver of the outages. Since the blackout, Texas lawmakers say the grid is more reliable and passed bills this year to try to incentivize the development of more on-demand generation, which does not include renewables. But even some Republicans continue raising concerns, and lawmakers have done little to address demand. Just before the heat wave settled into Texas, Republican Governor Greg Abbott vetoed a bill designed to strengthen energy efficiency in new construction, saying it wasn't as important as cutting property taxes. Doug Lewin, an energy consultant and the president of Stoic Energy, said he worries more about the grid in winter when there is more constant demand to keep homes warm. Any summer outages in Texas, he said, would likely be rotating outages that would last for a couple of hours. Still, he said, grid operators don't issue pleas to conserve power lightly. I don't think it's a cause for alarm, said Lewin, who also writes a newsletter on Texas energy. But yeah, it's a sure sign that things are getting fairly close to the edge. Texas isn't the only state watching supply and demand closely. The annual summer forecast by the North American Electric Reliability Corporation, which oversees the nation's grid reliability, put two-thirds of the continent at risk of shortfalls in the event that temperatures spike above normal. Four benefits of propane-powered school buses. Whether your child's school bus takes them around the block or across town, every child deserves a safe, clean, healthy ride to the classroom. There are diverse energy options that can achieve this goal, such as propane, which is environmentally friendly and affordable. Implementing solutions today, like propane-powered buses, can provide a better tomorrow for students. Consider these benefits of propane buses from the Propane Education and Research Council. Student health. Propane buses provide a variety of health benefits compared to diesel buses, including reducing harmful emissions that are known to cause respiratory issues like asthma and bronchitis, providing a quieter ride so students arrive calmer and ready to learn, offering a comfortable ride in a cabin that warms up quickly. And for the environment, propane reduces emissions that negatively impact air quality in a scalable, affordable way. In cost savings, propane and electric offer clean transportation, but the cost is not equal. A propane bus costs roughly one-third of an electric bus, meaning school districts can retire aging diesel fleets 3 times faster. And reliability. A range of 400 miles means propane buses offer reliable performance at long distances without stopping to refuel. Visit BetterOurBuses.com to find more information you can share with your students' school district leaders. Ring in the Fourth in downtown Odessa. Firecracker Fandango is back and will celebrate the 4th of July early on Saturday with numerous events and fireworks show. Firecracker Fandango is scheduled 6 to 10 p.m. Saturday and is a free event with games, food, and market vendors. "We're just so excited," Downtown Odessa Director Casey Hallmark said. "We're really eager to have this event. It's completely free to the public, and we're just fortunate to host this and have it be free and hopefully have a good turnout." Firecracker Fandango will feature 15 food trucks, as well as alcohol vendors and over 25 local market vendors, as well as a car show, circus performers, face painting, and performances by Rick Trevino and Tommy Targango. Battle of the Bands will also be going on at the Ector Theater at 6 p.m., which will be a $5 admission to anyone older than 12. A main stage will feature Tommy Targango and Rick Trevino. The Odessa Animal Shelter will also have a booth with adoptable pets, and the Ellen Noel Art Museum will provide a free children's craft. Jumpers and rock climbing walls will also be available, as well as a car show. The event will be complete with a 15-minute fireworks show. The fireworks show will take place at the corner of Grant and 2nd Street and will start at 9:45 p.m. On Monday, the Downtown Lions Club has scheduled a parade and a Let Freedom Ring event. The parade starts at 10 a.m. and will begin at 17th Street and Grant and travel south down Grant to end on 9th Street. The American Legion will host the Let Freedom Ring event with music, vendors, and food trucks. That event goes from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. New Mexico lawmakers question fallowing as a way to reduce water use along the Rio Grande. Some New Mexico lawmakers are warning that leaving farmland unplanted along one of North America's longest rivers won't be a long-term answer to ensuring Texas gets its share of the Rio Grande under a pending settlement that would end a years-long fight over the river's management. Members of the powerful Legislative Finance Committee met Tuesday in Las Cruces, not far from the border with Texas. On the agenda were briefings from top water managers about the history of the dispute and the creation of a task force that will be charged with developing a plan for implementing the proposed agreement. "The work ahead in the lower Rio Grande is significant, and we know that and we see that, and we're prepared to take it on. We have a plan," said Hannah Risley White, interim director of the Interstate Stream Commission. "That plan calls for reducing use through a combination of efforts that range from paying farmers not to pump groundwater to leasing surface water, fallowing farmland, and making infrastructure improvements. The proposed settlement, reached last fall by New Mexico, Texas, and Colorado, still needs the approval of a judge who has been overseeing the case and ultimately the U.S. Supreme Court. State Senator Joseph Cervantes, a Democrat from Las Cruces, argued that the settlement was far from a done deal, while other lawmakers said the burden of meeting water delivery obligations should not fall just to farmers in southern New Mexico. Some officials talked about fallowing land along the Rio Grande to reduce both diversions from the river and groundwater pumping that many farmers are forced to rely on in times of drought. In fact, it was pumping over the last two decades that prompted Texas to sue, arguing that the practice was cutting into the amount of water that was ultimately delivered as part of a decades-old water-sharing compact between Colorado, New Mexico, and Texas. Others at the meeting said focusing on infrastructure would result in more efficient use of the river. They also said stormwater runoff could be captured and managed to help recharge aquifers in southern New Mexico. Proposals at two dams along the southern reaches of the river call for building secondary ponds where runoff could be held for later release, so New Mexico would not lose out when storm surges send excess water beyond the state line. This infrastructure is absolutely necessary to adapt to this changing climate that we're in. It is necessary but not sufficient, said Phil King, an engineering consultant with Elephant Butte Irrigation District, the largest in New Mexico. We're definitely going to have to change the way we administer our water. King noted that farmers along the lower Rio Grande are not pumping any more water than they did between the early 1950s and late 1970s, a period that serves as the baseline condition. However, municipal and industry use has increased 250% since then, he said. Speaking to the fallowing efforts, King said, "Do you really want to go and slaughter the goose that lays the golden eggs, contributing to our economy and forming an important part of our culture? Or do you want to look at trying to use infrastructure first to minimize how much you have to reduce water use?" Cervantes said that while the proposed settlement would end the dispute with Texas, it will create a battle between users in southern and northern New Mexico, and that most farmers would not be willing to sell their land for the prices offered through the fallowing programs. Democratic Senator George Munzo, who chairs the Legislative Finance Committee, suggested money appropriated by the state legislature, as well as federal infrastructure funding, would be better spent on infrastructure improvements along the river. "We need to think about how we target the money we're going to use in this next year to fix some of these problems," he said. "But the Middle Rio Grande guys, my message to you is they're coming for you next. You better get ready because there's not enough water down south." Obituaries. Esperanza Hernandez, age 83, passed away on June the 23rd. Travis Baca, age 42, of Odessa, died Saturday, June the 24th. Sandra Jo Cox, age 80, of Odessa, died Sunday, June the 25th. Christopher Red Games, of Odessa, age 50, died Friday, June the 23rd. Franz Howard, age 74, passed away on Saturday, June the 24th. Rebecca Ann Johnson, age 75, of Odessa, died Thursday, June the 22nd. Robert Woody Motley, age 100, of Odessa, died Friday, June the 23rd.
This is the Dear Abby column. Man's treatment of female relatives has crossed line. Dear Abby, my daughter Leah and her husband Jerry visited his mother and stepdad Gil a few months ago. Gil gave Leah an inappropriate hug, with his hand sliding to her buttocks. Leah said Gil had done this before and it made her uncomfortable. She told Jerry, and he began watching his stepdad closely when they visited.
Recently, my family and I visited Jerry's parents. Gil gave me a hug around my back and then slid his hand down my back and grabbed my buttock with a quick squeeze. His wife was standing in front of us when he did it. I looked at her in shock. She looked down at the floor and then at me, expressionless. After I told my daughter what he had done, she told me he had done it to her as well. My son-in-law wants to tell his mother he doesn't feel comfortable leaving his young daughters at their house. I know Leah and I should have said something when it happened, but we were caught off guard and didn't call him on it. How do you think this should be handled? Signed, Caught Off Guard. Dear Caught Off Guard, your daughter was right to tell her husband what his stepdad has been doing, and you should tell him too, if you haven't already done it. Gil's behavior is extremely inappropriate. It's interesting that he doesn't discriminate. Anybody within reach appears to be fair game. You, your daughter, and Jerry need to explain that fact to Jerry's mother and her husband. From now on, it makes sense that Jerry's mother should visit her little granddaughters at Leah and Jerry's without her spouse. Dear Abby, I'm a high school senior who has dated a girl on and off. The first time, we didn't have a ton in common, but we enjoyed each other's company. She liked another guy, so after about 3 months, she broke up with me. I was okay with it. This year, I started hanging out with her again. We started kissing right away. She found someone online that she somehow got attracted to within a matter of hours, and 2 days later, I was dumped again. Her parents took her phone away the next day. She now says she regrets dumping me, and I'm always on her mind at some point in the day. She doesn't have high self-esteem or self-confidence. I think she feels disconnected because of her many years of homeschooling. She's also extremely depressed, I can tell that much. She has been talking to a therapist for a year, but it hasn't helped, and she's trying another one soon. I don't know how to help her or whether I should date her again. I love her, though, and want to know her better, but we are both confused. I worry I'm not a good fit for her, even if we are attracted. Please tell me how I can help her. Signed, Boy in Love in Georgia. Dear Boy in Love, you are right that the girl you're describing is confused. She's not ready for a relationship with anyone at this point. Before you can help her, it is important that you help yourself by recognizing that her problems are more complicated than you can deal with. This is not a reflection on you. Caring for her, loving her, is not enough. For your sake, take a step back. Be the friend she needs, but do not count on her for anything more until she has dealt with the issues that challenge her. You can write to Dear Abby at dearabby.com or P.O. Box 69440, Los Angeles, California, 90069. Her column is distributed by Universal Press Syndicate.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.